Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Time is tight, so I'll be quick. Today, two perspectives on global power. Peter Goodman talks about Davos Man, and Vijay Prashad outlines a plan to save the world, essentially, from Davos Man. Davos has become world famous as the annual gathering place for the global elite, sponsored by the World Economic Forum, and held every January in a mountain village in Switzerland. The forum and its founder, Klaus Schwab, like to present themselves as a bunch of do-gooders, but they're anything but. Peter Goodman, a reporter for the New York Times, is just out with a book on the event, its pretensions, and its realities, called Davos Man, How Billionaires Devoured the World, published by Custom House. Peter Goodman. Davos is a shorthand for an annual conference of the World Economic Forum, an entity that promotes itself as committed to improving the state of the world, even though it's mainly a gathering of very rich and very powerful. Could you give us a thumbnail sketch of the forum and its founder, Klaus Schwab?
The forum is sort of multiple events that all coincide in real time. You know, the most public facing version of the forum is this very earnest slate of panel discussions on all of the most weighty challenges of our time. You could go to panel discussions about climate change, about gender and racial inequality. But, you know, the jaded cool kids of the forum will tell you as a mark of sophistication that they never set foot inside the Congress Center. They just go to the banquets and the cocktail parties that are thrown by global banks and consulting companies. And these are just these kind of endless schmooze fests where CEOs run into other CEOs. And then the real action is actually in the Conference Center. It's these exclusive member-only events inside conference rooms that are closed, you know, even to forum participants, like, you know, I've been over the years, and closed to people with journalist credentials. So this is a chance for the head of an oil company to sit opposite a head of state in a negotiation that nobody knows about, that's not disclosed. And this was really the brainchild of the guy who started the forum, a guy named Klaus Schwab, who is this German economist who launched the forum in 1971. And at the time, it was this just sort of basic, let's get people from business to sit across a table from people in government to talk about solving issues. He's grown it into just a raging business. He figured out early on that there's lots of conferences where business people sit around talking about how to make money. There's plenty of conferences where well-intentioned academics talk to government officials. His marketing genius was to have the whole thing operate under this banner committed to improving the state of the world. You may be the head of a multinational company, but by going to this place where people are discussing inequality and climate change, you have signaled your virtue simply by being there, and your knowledge that there are other people like you will incentivize you to pay hundreds of thousands of dollars for a forum membership so that Klaus Schwab can play matchmaker and set you up in one of those quiet rooms so you can do the real business of the forum, which is deal making.
Now, these people are not the kinds of folks who lay out that kind of money unless they're going to get a return on it. I assume this is it just an ego return, or are there real financial returns?
Oh, no. This is a real financial return. I mean, there are major mergers that come out of Davos, you know, every year. Drug company executives will start their morning with meditation and mindfulness sessions led by Jon Kabat-Zinn, and then they'll retire to their private suites where they can plot their next merger engineered toward lifting drug prices. This is a place where people know they're going to meet other people they can do deals with, they can raise money, there are venture capitalists there, there are hedge funders there. This is a major place for business.
Yeah, and this is essentially where economic power and political power meet, and I don't want to use the word conspire because that's disreputable, but they do plan.
Huh. I mean, let's just say that they have access to information that people would not have if they were not habitually going to this conference. That's Schwab's genius. You know, publicly, he's selling this as, this is all of us up on a mountaintop talking about how to solve the world's problems under committed to improving the state of the world, which is incredibly ironic given that the people gathered there in the Swiss Alps are the ultimate beneficiaries of the status quo and have every incentive to perpetuate the status quo and protect themselves against anybody who has other ideas like economic redistribution. But that's also part of the genius of marketing. You know, by steeping the whole thing in, hey, we're the good guys, he can gather pharmaceutical industry CEOs. I mean, this is a real example. In a room to talk about the unaffordability of drug prices. It's just sort of unwritten code that by participating, well, you're clearly interested in tackling unaffordable drug prices. So the reason for unaffordable drug prices must be that we haven't thought about it hard enough. And that if we just all of us, you know, with the best of intentions, sit in a room and puzzle over it, good will come out of that.
I read about a poll of this year's attendees that found that they're very worried about social and ecological collapse. First of all, is that kind of standard fare? Are they always worried about something? And second of all, are they going to look at their own role in producing these crises?
Oh, they're professionally worried about stuff. They use worrying and pledging to do all this good stuff as a kind of prophylactic against actually having to do something they don't want to do, like handing over more of their money to the government. That's the whole charade at the center of it. You know, I got the idea for the book, actually, back in 2017 when Trump had just been elected, Brexit had happened. I was living in London then. I took note of the fact that the forum seemed to be nodding through its selection of seminars as clearly something has gone awry in the global economy. Right-wing populism is on the march. This is a reflection of inequality. We've got to get our arms around inequality. And there was this sort of sense of it's either that or the pitchforks are going to show up at our gates. So there were all these panels that year on inequality and on future models for capitalism 2.0, like all this kind of thing. So I ran around surveying, you know, what solutions were on offer. And I listened to Ray Dalio, who was a hedge fund guy who at that point I think was worth about $17 billion, say that the solution to inequality was to deregulate further, to make the markets more conducive for money making, which was an interesting thing to hear from someone who had somehow managed to make
it. What could be done at that point?
Right. You know, I listened to the CEO of a large Indian consulting company talk about how workers have to take responsibility for their own training. My former boss, Arianna Huffington, who at that point had just launched this new wellness site that was aimed at vacuuming up sponsorships from spas, essentially said, you know, people have to meditate more, they need comfier pillows, they need to sleep more. You know, I heard everything except for some of us here need to give up some of our wealth in the form of progressive taxation. We've got to allow labor to bargain for better working conditions and wages. Maybe we're going to have to accept antitrust enforcement so that our monopoly power will be checked. Like, none of the things that would actually potentially address inequality were on the offer. It was all about win-win solutions. You know, Davos Man loves win-win solutions and other constructions that make sacrifice unnecessary. Because if everybody wins, then why should anybody have to give up anything?
But in 2017, that's when they welcomed Trump, right? He came through with his tax cuts.
It was the following year.
The following year,
they welcomed Trump. And that was also like a very revealing look at what really animates the forum. Because that year, I was there too, there was this sense, I think most of the conventional press coverage was, you know, this is a clash for the ages. Here's Trump, who's a wrecking ball aimed at the liberal democratic order. He's pulled the U.S. out of the Paris Climate Agreement. You know, he stands for everything that's anathema to this group of globalists who believe in international cooperation. And of course, you know, as I'm saying, like the real Davos, the people who pay the bills, these are global banks, these are consulting companies, these are giant technology companies. And what they care about is tax cuts and deregulation. And Trump had just made the heavens rain money, courtesy of this $1.5 trillion package of tax cuts, mostly lavished on the sorts of people who hang out at the forum. So there was a kind of public show of being uncomfortable. Certainly the African diplomats were not happy with, I'm not going to use the colorful phrase that Trump used, but it involves a bathroom metaphor and countries. They weren't delighted to be, you know, hearing about that. The well-intentioned, you know, non-governmental organization people, the activists, they were sort of horrified that Trump was there. And Klaus Schwab, who never lets his stated principles stand in the way of ingratiating himself with powerful people, actually praised Trump for boosting inclusiveness in the United States, which was kind of remarkable. And he went out of his way to give Trump this clean pass. He said, we understand that your leadership is subject to misunderstandings, and that's why we're so happy to hear from you personally. I mean, I've watched Klaus Schwab, you know, praise Narendra Modi, the Indian president who has questioned citizenship for the members of the Muslim minority.
He's a member of what is literally the oldest fascist party in the world. So
I mean, he's a Hindu supremacist, right? Klaus Schwab is remarkable.
It does seem that these people hate taxes more than anything else. These are folks who could spare $1 billion. You know, it's what do you think motivates that? Is it really about the money, or is there something else involved too? Is there some kind of psychological or emotional intensity in their reaction that drives their reaction to the idea of being taxed?
You know, I think part of what animates Davos Man is this ability, and I refer to Davos Man as like a species of billionaire, right? I'm giving you a taxonomy of Davos Man. It's this incredible ability to fashion a self-serving narrative and then internalize it. Mark Benioff, who's the CEO of Salesforce, this large Silicon Valley tech company, said at the virtual Davos last year, they couldn't meet in person because of the pandemic. He said, CEOs are the real heroes of the pandemic.
Yeah, that's some rich material there. The Benioff's comments are just unbelievable.
Right. And some people are, I mean, there's like an editorial written by a guy from the American Enterprise Institute, this think tank that essentially works in the service of Davos Man, that calls that a gaffe. I don't think that's a gaffe. That's a glimpse into a worldview. And he went on to say, you know, CEOs delivered your vaccines and we got your PPE and we delivered credit, which staved off bankruptcies. The government didn't save you, he said. We saved you, and not for profit, but to save the world. In that construction is the animating notion of Davos Man, which is we're the good guys. And because we're the good guys, we need more. The more we've got, the more good we can do. We can do good through our philanthropy. We can do good through what I call in the book the cosmic lie, you know, the demonstrably bogus idea that if you cut taxes and deregulate large companies, the benefits will just magically trickle down to everyone else, something that in real life has happened zero times. But these guys really internalize this and really believe it. Take somebody like Larry Fink, who's the founder of BlackRock, the world's largest asset management company. I mean, this is a guy who actually controls $10 trillion in assets. This is like university endowments. This is pension funds around the world. And he and Benioff are the champions of this thing they call stakeholder capitalism, this idea that Milton Friedmanism is dead. No longer are companies just organized to return profit to shareholders. They're organized as agents of social progress, answerable to stakeholders, the environment, labor.
I'm speaking with Peter Goodman, author of Davos Man, just out from Custom House. That stakeholder concept is really important to them, too, right?
It's hugely important, and it's also a way of essentially saying, hey, we've got this. We'll take care of all your problems ourselves through our own beneficence, and therefore you don't have to tax us and regulate us. And yet Larry Fink goes to Davos in the desert, which is this kind of World Economic Forum-like event thrown by the Saudi monarchy just a couple of months after the Khashoggi murder, and he goes and lends legitimacy. I mean, he presents himself as this environmental steward who's urging companies publicly to get right with climate change. He's raising $15 billion for Saudi Aramco to build a natural gas pipeline. He controls, I believe it's the third largest block of shares of JBS, the Brazilian meatpacker that's clear-cutting the Amazon. You know, this is not like the robber barons who are content to kind of do what they need to do. They'll brutalize labor. They'll hire agents to do all sorts of nefarious things while hiding away. These guys aren't hiding away. They're front and center asking for our adulation. And that's what they use to protect themselves from taxes and regulation.
Larry Fink also has a special relationship with the Federal Reserve through the last couple of financial crises, right?
Oh, I mean, he's the Wizard of Oz, says, you know, the former investment banker turned journalist, William Cohen. He's the guy behind the curtain. I mean, he's a guy who manages so much money that it's reasonable to understand that the Federal Reserve and the Treasury would view him as somebody who knows more about the flows of money than anybody else. But, you know, he's sort of looking at us and winking and saying, Hey, of course, you know, I'm on the side of good. I'm on the side of societal interest, not just the narrow interests of my company. Well, okay, what we've learned from the most recent deals that he's gotten. So both after the global financial crisis of 2008 and again during the crash in the markets of March 2020, Larry Fink's BlackRock got the gig as the effective financial advisor and portfolio manager for Uncle Sam. So at a time when the Fed is buying up a whole bunch of assets to try to bolster assets, he's the guy who gets to decide what they're buying. So guess what? A lot of that money ends up in exchange-traded funds, you know, these sort of mutual fund-like assets comprised of a whole basket of assets run by his company, BlackRock. So in the run-up to his selection of which of these exchange-traded funds should get federal money, investors are pouring into them on the totally reasonable assumption that those funds are going to go up since more money is going to pour into them. And the punchline of this is we've now seen the contracts under which he's advising the federal government. Because when some people like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez publicly accused him of this massive conflict of interest, how can you run a giant financial firm and also advise Uncle Sam on where to put its money? And he took offense at this. How can you question my judgment? And of course, these are two separate sides of the business. Well, it turns out that under the actual contracts with the federal government, BlackRock people can go onto the other side of the fence. They can go advise the Fed, see what the Fed's doing, see how the Fed is thinking about the world, plan their portfolio purchases accordingly. And then after a two-week cooling off period, they can go back to their regular jobs advising people with money for BlackRock.
It reminds me, Marx in Capital quoted a 19th century British banker, I think in parliamentary testimony, saying, "All fluctuations are of value to the knowing man." Larry Fink became that knowing man.
I mean, information is money, no question.
One thing that struck me is that robber barons of the late 19th century, early 20th, felt a need to legitimate themselves. Carnegie built libraries, Rockefeller University's Riverside Church. Bezos shoots himself into space.
Right.
Do you think these guys think that their wealth alone now legitimates them?
Oh, I think Bezos is a guy who really does view, you know, his going to space as like, that's a leap for all of humanity and you're welcome. I mean, similar to Benioff, you know, saying CEOs are the heroes of the pandemic. I mean, Bezos, of course, famously comes down from his, what was it, 11 or 14 minutes in, out in space. He lands and then he thanks Amazon employees for helping him amass this fortune that enables this great leap, which kind of signals that he believes, like, whatever's happening to me, we're all winning. Now, let's remember that while Bezos is amassing the fortune to get to space, the people he's left on the ground are laboring in warehouses in the initial wave of the pandemic without PPE. I mean, they don't have hand sanitizers. They don't have gowns. They don't have face masks. They don't have any clarity on how much COVID is in their facilities. When Christian Smalls, who leads this kind of labor uprising at a warehouse in Staten Island, says, let's not stand for this. Let's walk out. He's actually fired officially for violating quarantine, which is incredible given that, you know, he wants everyone to be quarantined, but with pay. And of course, Amazon, I mean, none of this is by accident, has lobbied for years to prevent any kind of mandate for paid sick leave. So while Bezos is going to space and celebrating, it's not that he's doing so well while his warehouse employees are not doing well. It's he's amassing a fortune because his warehouse employees are not doing well. There are costs to be ruthlessly managed out of the equation, and that's what Jeff Bezos does, even as he's signing off on all these stakeholder capitalism pledges, and even as he's suggesting that Amazon is doing this heroic work by outfitting us all, which they are to some degree. I mean, thank goodness for e-commerce. How would we have survived the pandemic without e-commerce? But he's set up the system where he's monopolizing the gains of that system and leaving his own people having to choose between their paychecks or their health.
You read about Davos Man mostly, the peak of the peak of a certain, you know, capitalist class. But what about strata below them, like middle management, even provincial business people and professionals who are often the important basis of support for Trump and Trump-style politics? You know, some of them actually hate Davos Man, hate the metropolitan elites. How do they fit into this picture? And Davos Man so powerful that he rules regardless of what those just below him think and act, or do they have some kind of complex relationship?
You know, this is not like a puppeteer kind of conspiracy that I'm presenting here, right? It's much more subtle than that. I mean, it's something that's played out literally over decades, so gradually as to effectively be invisible. You know, it's sort of like climate change, right? Like, nobody's really noticing the 1/1000th of a millimeter that the water's rising in such a place, or the drip, drip, drip of a glacier, until suddenly there's a crisis and we're dealing with a storm. And that crisis is upon us now in the form of the pandemic. So, you know, there's all sorts of different views on Trumpism. There's all sorts of different views on the globalists. You know, Bannon, of course, makes a lot of hay out of the globalists. Trump himself, you know, rides to power on the notion that globalization is some sort of plot against America, never mind that the U.S. is the greatest beneficiary of globalization. And the problem is not globalization and trade per se. It's who's crafting the policies, who's determining who gets the benefits. As I argue in the book, like, it's wrong to throw out trade, which actually has been a very progressive force throughout modern history. We need to look at the fact that things like China's entry to the WTO, NAFTA, you know, these were crafted by the Davos men with their own interests. It's not that we shouldn't be trading with the rest of the world. It's that we need mechanisms to redistribute the gains and to have there be rules in place to protect working people. I mean, Trump rides to power telling people that China's our problem. China's clearly a serious challenge in the global trading system, one not easily solved. But make no mistake, I mean, the labor crisis, the steady wage crisis, the erosion of living standards, the destruction of the middle class in the United States, this is not a made-in-China phenomenon. This is a made-in-New York boardroom, made-in-Seattle boardroom, made-in-Congress, and in successive administrations and White House's problem. These are home-cooked problems, and it creates, you know, opportunities for movements that then point at the outsiders as they ride their way to power. That was Trump's genius, was understanding that through the chaos and the uncertainty, but the deep knowledge that people felt that they'd been getting screwed for years, he could cater to fears and ride his way to power. And that's a template that's been followed, you know, in the UK via Brexit. That's Marine Le Pen's strategy in France. That's how the Italian right wing has gained force. That's how Sweden, the supposed bastion of social democracy, you know, is now a country where a party with its roots in the neo-Nazi movement is now, you know, the third most popular party in the country.
It's interesting detail in your book. How about you spend a few pages outlining how a branch of Davos man helped design Brexit, a bunch of hedge fund guys and such, who wanted to be free of regulation. So it was not just anti-Davos man that was behind Brexit. There was at least a segment of Davos man who also was.
Yeah, I mean, that's a particularly cynical example, right? So Britain comes out of the global financial crisis with George Osborne running the Treasury, who prescribes crippling austerity, right? So they reduce taxes on some businesses. The rich people get some tax perks. Meanwhile, he says, oh, we've been living beyond our means. And so they slash this once quite generous social welfare state. The national healthcare system gets cut. It becomes harder for people to get any help with housing if they need it. A whole range of benefits for people who need assistance, you know, get cut. And after 10 years of this, there's just a lot of anger and a lot of accusation with no clear channel. And the Conservative Party, for reasons too tedious to go into at length, you know, has long debated over Britain's membership in the European Union as a sort of proxy on the civil war within the Conservative Party. And David Cameron, the then prime minister, decides to lance the boil once and for all. We're going to put this vote before the public, Brexit. And of course, they'll vote it down because that's a sensible thing to do. We'll get on with our lives as members of the European Union. Meanwhile, a cynical group of hedge funders decide that this is a wonderful way to get Britain out of the European Union and out from under European financial regulations imposed after the financial crisis. And so for them, you know, they're talking about sovereignty. I mean, really, Brexit more than anything is a reaction to immigration. And they do a lot of fear mongering about refugees showing up from Turkey and across the Middle East. I mean, this was all just nonsense. They make a bunch of vacuous, you know, bogus promises about how much money Europe will be recovered instead of having to pay the European Union budget. And never mind that Britain receives all this money from the European Union and the trade will be damaged. But really what happens is these hedge fund guys underwrite the Leave campaign, and they play on all of these fears, these nativist fears, as a way to get out from under regulation. And so the end result is Britain Brexits. It damages the economy for precisely the people it was supposed to help, at least in name, you know, these laid off manufacturing workers in places like the north of England. And the hedge fund guys are now going to revel in this new kind of sovereignty where Britain gets back to just serving the interests of moneyed special interest groups.
That was Peter Goodman, author of Davos Man from Custom House. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News, back after a musical break. That was some of the title track of Toxic Materialism, an EP by Bergsonist, a DJ originally from Morocco, now based in New York. Next, a plan to save the world. Since the middle of last year, a group of 26 research institutes from around the world have been putting together what is nothing less than a plan to save the world from the likes of Davos Man. The director of one of those institutes, Vijay Prashad of the Tricontinental, is here to talk about it. Vijay Prashad is an Indian historian and journalist, with 30 books to his name. Later this year, the New Press will publish The Withdrawal, Iraq, Libya, Afghanistan, and the Fragility of U.S. Power, co-authored with Noam Chomsky. Vijay Prashad. So, Vijay, you've got a plan to save the world. I'm always impressed by those. Tell me about this. We will build the future to save the planet. What is it?
Let's start from the other point of view, which is that, you know, we've seen what the pandemic has meant for lots of people. And, of course, unevenly, because certain countries might make a faster recovery than others out of the pandemic. But nonetheless, the pandemic has demonstrated real long-term vulnerabilities. You know, I guess there are two schools of thought in this. One is that the pandemic has created a problem. The other is that the pandemic exacerbated or revealed a problem. And I'm generally of the second school of thought here, that there were some really problematic things in the world economy. There's just a lot of money that's not entering into productive activity, whether it's gone into the 37 trillion or whatever amount you decide to agree on, that's gone into illicit tax havens, or it's the money that's sitting in various financial instruments.
The wealth of the billionaire class has just soared over the last year and a half. I mean, it's just gotten worse.
That's right. And in fact, it's gotten worse in absolute terms, but the trend lines were already there. We see that the pandemic has really shown that there was rot in the foundations of the house. And well, out of the door comes the World Economic Forum. Out of the door comes this new outfit that I don't know how many of your listeners follow, but it's called the Council for Inclusive Capitalism. It was set up by a very strange coalition of the Vatican, of the Bank of London and others, you know, really odd bedfellows in the Council for Inclusive Capitalism. And they've basically come out saying, look, we know there are problems in the capitalist system. They can be solved. The term of the day is inclusive capitalism. Let's produce an inclusive capitalism. I don't even know what that is. Most recently, you look at some of the press statements from the business press and the Financial Times, Wall Street Journal. There is anxiety about social inequality, but they don't seem to have any, you know, illusions of an inclusive capitalism. They understand prosperity and profit and so on. But anyway, There have been plans coming out of the World Economic Forum, this council. And
did you see the poll that the World Economic Forum did of their members? And they're all worried about social and ecological collapse. But of course, they're not willing to investigate their own role in creating that situation.
That they are worried about the collapse is interesting, and this is not unusual. I remember in the 1970s how the Bank of America's head at the time, who later goes to head the World Bank, you know, was publicly saying that, look, if we don't do anything, our houses are going to be set on fire by the mob. What has to motivate us to now inclusive capitalism or perhaps social responsibility or whatever you say isn't some inherent liberalism or humanism. It's basically fear of the Molotov cocktail. Now it's fear of the Molotov cocktail and fear that you'll be burnt by a hot sun. And I think these two things have created a certain panic among the ruling classes in the world. But their solutions to them, they are basically, let's do the same thing, but let's do more of the same thing. Let's try our best to raise some money for the carbon transition. Although I'm of the view that this carbon transition, and I experienced this directly in Glasgow, Doug, talking to corporate executives there, what they're really talking about isn't save the planet. What they're talking about is how do we modernize capitalism? How do we get public funds to enter into the private sector to modernize capitalism? You know, how do we move from carbon to, say, renewable energy? Not because we want to save the planet alone, although there is that, but because they know that carbon is not going to be necessarily around forever and also not the most efficient way of both producing what they need to produce and appealing to their consumer base, who are actually terrified that we are approaching extinction. They're just not serious people in the ruling class. So 26 research institutes, we got together. We've had a lot of conversations over the past year. Fascinating people, interesting ideas. And we said, look, let's put together our plan. Even if our plan is maybe perhaps looks utopian to people, let's just have something on the table, you know. When you have something on the table that you can bang down onto the table and say, look, here's this as well, then maybe we have a fighting chance of having a debate. But if you're just criticizing their plans, then you don't seem to have anything of your own. I think that was the motivation.
Now, I notice in your, I don't know what you call it, a manifesto or what the piece I was reading on the web, you have a section called Blaming China, which, of course, is a popular explanation for everything that's wrong in the world today. It's all China's fault, right?
Well, I mean, it's convenient, you know, that China is a power that until 1820 was one of the leading economic forces and certainly in its part of the world, an important political force, that is to say in Asia at that time. And then China suffered, you know, more than a century of what the Chinese academics call a century of humiliation. And you see, you don't need to take the Chinese scholars' word for it if you don't trust anything about China. And by the way, that's become like a panic. Anything coming from China is treated as suspicious. Anything coming from a U.S. intelligence agency, well, you know, let's at least hear what they're saying. Very strange standard that people have now. But anyway, you know, you can look at pretty mainstream books like The Great Divergence, you know, which shows you that up till about 1820, the Chinese economy was doing great. And then, well, colonialism, and they had this century of humiliation. Well, now China has, in a way, come back to the path that it was perhaps already on, or people don't like teleological explanations. Fine, it's back to a path where it is seeing considerable growth, where for the last 35 years, this growth has come alongside great social inequality. There's been some debate inside China. The Communist Party there has 90 million people. You know, they've been debating what this is. Xi Jinping happens to represent the more left side of the party. There's people further to his left, of course, but he's more to the left. He has argued for engaging the social inequality problem, dealing with poverty and so on. They are on their own debate and they have their own issues that they're dealing with. But it's bizarre. The rise of China, particularly around tech, I'm talking now serious tech, Doug, telecommunications, robotics, green technology of various kinds, high-speed rail. The Chinese are considerably ahead of Western companies, and I think that's really provoking a lot of anxiety.
Well, you know, they moved from being, you know, the low-wage sweatshop to being, you know, formidable technical power on their own.
I remember well when, I think his name is Tim Scott, went to meet Donald Trump during the, you know, the high point of the trade war against China that Trump was prosecuting. Scott is the head of Apple. You know, Apple sources I don't know the numbers, 85-90% of his products are finished up in China at Foxconn and different companies. And despite all that, despite the hit that Apple was taking, Scott went to see Donald Trump during the trade war, and he didn't say, hey, listen, Donald, let's cool down on this trade war with China. It's hurting Apple, one of the premier U.S. companies. No, what he went and said is, go on with this trade war because we'll take the short-term pain. We don't want the long-term problem of having Huawei or ZTE X us out by overtaking us in the tech field. But what he was complaining about is the trade war is actually benefiting Samsung, which is the Korean company. That's all he complained about, which shows you that the U.S. ruling class was basically united behind this trade war. This wasn't a Republican and Democratic thing. It wasn't a Silicon Valley versus, you know, the kind of smokestack tech industries of the United States. They were all basically united. Stop China now before it actually eclipses us economically. I think that was the message Trump got loud and clear, and Biden has that as well.
All right, well, now let's turn to some more uplifting material. Saving the planet. What's this broad plan that you've put together, you and your colleagues?
It's a range of things. And what we've done is what we do with a lot of our work. We went and talked to trade unions. We went to talk to mass organizations. We talked to a range of people, healthcare unions and so on. And we built many of our suggestions from the things that we got from them. You know, for instance, in the section on housing, we talked to tenant right unions and so on. Talked to them, what kind of things do you need? What kind of things are important? Some things are obvious, rent control on rental housing units and so on. After we put together the drafts, we had serious debate among the 26 research institutes. Some things people wanted to put on the table. Others found that, look, that's not possible. It's either not feasible or I don't think it's defendable, you know, and so on. So we've come up with a pretty good plan. I mean, I think the key element in any plan you make to so-called save the planet is one on political power in the world and secondly on finance. In terms of political power, essentially we are mimicking the UN Charter. You know, we're calling for adherence to the UN Charter. The UN Charter, Doug, is the most highly consensus-driven document in the world. 193 countries have treated it as a binding treaty. There is no other piece of paper that is actually a binding treaty of almost everybody on the planet. That's incredible. If we could actually follow the UN Charter, part one of our text is established, which is global democracy, and where we once again take the General Assembly seriously and not just the Security Council and so on. The kind of mafia attitude of the United States in these global bodies simply cannot be allowed. You know, the test case of this is in responsibility to protect, the doctrine by which the US and NATO went to war in Libya. It's really interesting because the UN responsibility to protect doctrine says that any time a country or a group of countries wants to act against another country to prevent something like a genocide, you need a UN Security Council resolution. That's the UN version of responsibility to protect. The United States doesn't follow the UN version. It follows Gareth Evans' report. Gareth Evans was the foreign minister of Australia, who basically was gung-ho for the Indonesian invasion of East Timor and so on. A man who has limited credibility for global democracy. Anyway, Gareth Evans, in his report on responsibility to protect, said that, well, yes, you need a UN Security Council resolution, except when a regional organization provides its own resolution. In other words, if NATO votes to intervene, then that's also in accordance with international law. But it simply is not. And that's what they did in many interventions. You know, we know, for instance, that in the intervention in Libya, there was a mandate, but it was not exactly what the United States and France followed in Libya itself. So one part is, let's follow the UN Charter. On finance, we have some interesting ideas that we want to put in on the table. For instance, I think it's a pretty liberal demand. I don't know what you feel about it. It's a pretty liberal demand that all assets in illicit tax havens should be seized. That's $37 trillion. We already call them illicit tax havens. Last I checked, illicit is not a good word. I don't understand why there isn't more global appetite to just seize the assets there, you know. Bring them back into circulation. That's a lot of money. You know, you're looking for money for a Green New Deal, for infrastructure, etc. Put that money to use.
This is the voice of Vijay Prashad, director of the Tricontinental, a global people's think tank.
Odious debts of countries. During the pandemic, Doug, if you look at World Bank documents and their studies, during the pandemic, the cost of borrowing for developing countries increased by 10%. This is at a time when the IMF has shown that the central banks of the advanced countries raised $16 trillion to basically cover the bills for this, that, and everything, you know, including income support to people and so on. Perfectly good things. Most of it was perfectly good. There were some boondoggles, you know, money going to big corporations and so on. But $16 trillion was created by central banks out of what, Doug? You tell me. You've written a book on Wall Street. When they want to, they make money. We know that. That was easy for the advanced countries to do. But, you know, what's a country like Burundi to do? Burundi is going to get 70% of its population vaccinated by 2100, okay, at the current rate at which people are being vaccinated. 2100. So how is Burundi going to raise money? Well, price of borrowing for Burundi has gone up. Why? Because the basic confidence in Burundi is down. One piece of why the confidence is so down is there's no vaccination, you know. This has to be on the table. We believe that odious debts need to be cancelled immediately. Who'll bear the cost of the debts? Well, you know, what about the people who actually made the loans? You can't have this attitude of making loans which you know are super risky, and then when people can't pay the loans back, you punish them 5 or 6 times more than you'd punish anybody else, and you don't bear any risk, you know? It's an interesting kind of capitalism we have, where the people with capital don't want to actually use their capital. They borrow public money. They don't want to take any risk. They want to guarantee their own return. I mean, this is the kind of thing that's been really imposed on the developing world, and we want to sharpen our discussions about that, call attention to some of these things, you know. And so that's another thing that's important, and we already know that there is general, well, I won't call it consensus, but there's a general agreement on taxes, particularly on inheritance taxes. And yet in the last decades, 5 or 6 decades, there's been a real drift away from exercising our right to saying, look, every generation should start not from scratch, but not with these enormous advantages that inheritance taxes need to be taken seriously. Well, I believe that a large inheritance just kills any initiative in populations. And man, you can see that in the United States, where 4 or 5 generations into a lot of money, I'm not sure what these people are doing.
Well, this is a rotting culture, I guess. So
isn't it? I mean, there was a moment where I visited a few friends in one of those workshare places where you can take an office or a desk. And there was a guy in that workshop place, a really nice guy, got into a conversation with him. He was a trust fund guy. He basically comes to that place to check his Facebook. And he's an intelligent person, you know, and I thought, my God, you know, you could make such a contribution to your culture. There's so many things you could do. Coming in here, paying a fee just so that you're not checking Facebook at home is a pretty miserable way for a society's elites to exist, you know. There's got to be something. So, you know, inheritance tax, I feel that, you know, 40, 50 years ago, there was a widespread consensus that, look, when you die, let's say 50% of your assets should go into the social coffers, you know, or some amount, 25%. Now the number is so limited because the ways in which people protect their assets is so incredibly sophisticated. So we feel that if you look carefully at the ways in which you can harness resources to do real things, you know, I'm fed up with the argument, well, where's the money going to come from? And so we made a list basically of, you know, just what, 14 points of, well, this is where the money can come from. You want to know where the money comes from? Well, these are ways you can do it. I mean, why don't we democratize banking? In a place like India, democratizing banking is so important. You know, during the 50, 60 years before we liberalized or opened up the Indian economy, there were actual agrarian credit unions where farmers would go and they would borrow money because farming requires a lot of income support, subsidies of all kinds, including cheap money. You'd borrow money and essentially, you know, it's not like the loans were forgiven, but the rates of borrowing were so low. The forgiveness rates were also high. As I said, it was not 100% forgiveness, but people were forgiven. But the most important thing was the length of the loans were pretty good. You know, they were not short-term loans. They were pretty long loans. people would pay back and so on. But that wasn't the point. The point was to promote agriculture, and particularly agriculture of a sort where the farmers were also able to eat. Indian farmers have been on strike for a year. They had this huge protest against the possibility that they would get Uberized. And this is a direct consequence of the fact that India basically shut down all the government agricultural credit unions. Same thing happened in the US in the 1970s and 80s, you know, which is why you had Willie Nelson and Farm Aid. We no longer have a democratic banking system. I know it sounds crazy even to say that, but we don't have democratic banking systems, and we need to have those. From the point of view of capitalism, I get it. If I have money and I'm less risky, money is actually cheaper for me to borrow because there's a less chance that I'm going to default on it and so on. If I don't have any money and it's therefore a risky bet, the money is more expensive. But if you keep doing that, you're going to just generate social inequality at enormous rates, you know, because you need to provide money to people who don't have assets at a rate that's reasonable, where they can go and do interesting things with it and are able to pay it back. That's a democratic banking system which doesn't penalize people because they're poor and therefore a higher risk. And this goes not only to individuals but to countries. Why should a rich country with sometimes a high debt overhang, why should a rich country borrow at a better rate than a poor country, you know, which maybe has struggled through austerity to keep the debt down? And that's the way it is right now in the world. It's totally undemocratic.
But what do you have on climate?
Yeah, that's the very difficult one, but also not so difficult. Again, because one of those unusual people, Doug, I take the United Nations really seriously. You know, I read the documents, I look carefully at what the UN is saying. And one of the reasons I do that is because the UN produces consensus statements. In Rio in 1992, the world gathered and they decided on a declaration, very important declaration, which had a phrase in it called common and differentiated responsibilities. Super interesting phrase. What that meant was, look, whoever is destroying the planet, it doesn't matter who it is, we have a common problem that we're all going to get, you know, burnt alive. But there are common responsibilities. Everybody has to do something. But then there are differentiated responsibilities. The idea there was, and then taken up by in the climate debate, is that, look, the Western countries that advanced spectacularly in the 18th and 19th century, they took up a disproportionate share of the carbon budget. In other words, they screwed the world more than anybody else. Therefore, they have a net responsibility to do two things. One is to help other countries get beyond the carbon civilization to the next phase, and as well to help mitigate what you know, this crisis has produced. Like when islands start to disappear and so on, there should be a concept of climate refugees. Richer countries should be taking in climate refugees, not letting them drown. Anyway, the point is here, you've already committed $100 billion into a climate fund. You've only put just a handful of billion into that. We don't want billions. We want trillions. We also want the kind of TRIPS debate to be reopened. In other words, the trade-related intellectual property rights debate. This was a big debate in the General Agreement on Trade and Tariffs, the Uruguay round, the last round of GATT, which became the World Trade Organization. They changed the whole debate on patents by saying what we patent is the product, not the process. And by doing that, you basically don't allow countries to reverse engineer products, you know, come up with different ways of making things. For instance, solar panels and so on. So what the argument is that, look, the richer world needs to, on the one hand, contribute to the climate fund, which you've agreed to contribute to. It's a small amount of money, haven't even met that money. Secondly, we need to see much more technology transfer, but also science transfer. You know, technology is yesterday's science, Doug. We want science, which is tomorrow's technology. So that means that we have to really rethink the whole patent regime, because this is preventing global scientific advances. You know, so many new scientific developments are behind patent walls, and the vaccine thing has shown this to people, you know, in a really tangible way. So for climate, it's not just about plastic bags and so on, you know, and recycling. It's about some of these big issues which relate, in fact, to the trade and development agenda. You know, that's where we have to look. And at the same time, I would suggest, and I'm not a Luddite or, you know, eat local type person, because I don't believe that is actually going to save anything. I still do believe that we need to really think about the global supply chain, and we need to create much more regionally robust economies, you know, not economies where you rely on the movement of things that you should be producing in your own country. But I'm not saying it from the standpoint of, you know, let's go local and everything local, because that's absurd. We are not going back to that. That simply means the end of the kind of civilization we live in now. Everything is not available locally. You know, try, for instance, digging in your backyard in Brooklyn for phosphate. You won't find it. And if you can't find phosphate in your backyard, there's no fertilizer, you know, in New York State. You're going to have to get it from Morocco or somewhere where they actually have phosphate. So you can't go to everything local. That's just, to my mind, that's a kind of ignorant political opinion. But you should be able to rethink how supply chains are working.
All right, we're just about out of time, but I got to say, this all sounds very reasonable and almost moderate to me. You're going soft. There's nothing about expropriating the bourgeoisie.
Yeah, I mean, it is extremely moderate. And I think that reality is leading us in this direction. In other words, if we're going to get to expropriating the bourgeoisie, we have to first produce that in real life. I mean, you know, there's no point you and me saying, let's expropriate the bourgeoisie, you know. I thought Marx and Engels were quite right in the German ideology when they said, well, you know, socialism is the real movement of history. Actually, they said communism is the real movement of history. It's not ideas inserted into the world. So we have to be, you know, looking out of our windows and saying, what's the real movement of history doing? It's definitely moving in the direction of the things we're talking about in this plan. And perhaps as political life advances and you know, goes in another direction, we will be at some point, Doug, you and I, standing on a building yelling, expropriate the bourgeoisie. We're not there yet. I mean, how many people will come behind you when you yell that?
That was Vijay Prashad, director of the Tricontinental, a people's think tank. You can read about the plan to save the planet on their website, thetricontinental.org. Vijay mentioned the Council for Inclusive Capitalism. Among its members is the very Mark Benioff of Salesforce, whom Peter Goodman talked about earlier, one of the chief publicists for stakeholder capitalism. He was, no surprise here, a prominent participant in Bill Clinton's pseudo-philanthropic extravaganzas of self-regard organized by his eponymous foundation. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, apropos of nothing but his charming oddity, Lana Del Rey doing a setting of T.S. Eliot's Burnt Norton. Till next week, bye.
Time present and time past are both perhaps present and time future. And time future contained in time past. If all time is eternally present, all time is unredeemable. What might have been is an abstraction, remaining a perpetual possibility, only in a world of speculation. What might have been and what has been point to one end, which is always present. Footfalls echo in the memory, down the passage, which we did not take, towards the door.